G'day listeners, Aaron here. Before we get started on this episode, this is our new initiative called The Bloop Testing Grounds, where we're going to try out different pilots or one-offs or things like that. Maybe we've got an idea for a show that won't last beyond one episode, so orphaned pilots can go here too. So either way, I hope you enjoy this, and I'll leave details at the end where you can let us know if it worked or if it was a failure. Enjoy.
Welcome to the Blooming League of Original Podcasts.
G'day, you've been caught in the act, the interview interrogation where we take the actor out of character and find out what lies beneath the portrayal. I'm Aaron, and for today's episode, I've caught Jonathan Wagner in the act, or Mr. J. Wags from Thrash and Treasure. How are you going?
I'm going pretty good, and I bet the audience is wondering, well, how did you get this guy? He must have been so hard to get.
I know, right? Considering all the other bloody hard gets we've gotten on the show.
I've had such a fun time with that.
How are you going?
I'm going pretty good. Right now I'm working at the new Second City, New York. We have just opened out there, and I am music directing, composing, and sound designing for what we call NYCO. It's the group that does the best of the Second City. We're doing three shows a week, Saturday, Monday, and Tuesday. And I'm understudying the main stage show, which is right now called The First City Review, but the official title will be out in a couple weeks as they open on February 18th. So if you're interested, check out secondcity.com for all of the ticket information.
February 18th?
April 18th. Did I say February?
You did.
Well, I meant wait.
Thought so. And technically, isn't it now the third city?
No. New York is the first city. Second, well, they called Chicago the second city for a while, and that's where the name of the theater came from. So, I mean, in terms of population, Chicago is three or four in the U.S.
Oh, okay. And there's Toronto.
And there is one in Toronto. There were a bunch. We had one in Vegas. We had one in Cleveland. I think there was one in Denver for a little bit. And then we were on cruise ships for about a decade. It's a fascinating comedy brand. And I've been working in Second City on and off for about, I think at this point, 17 years of my life.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, it's good to be back in sort of my artistic home. It's a lot of fun.
Awesome. I'm very proud. Anyways, last year you played Willy Wonka. So today we're going to explore that character in this new show that is all about the characters and the actor's approach to them. Because as a writer myself, that's one thing I can only lay out so much on the page. Life is breathed into it by the actor.
Yeah.
So I wanted to explore that and find out your take on it. The character that we'll talk about, which we'll talk about Willy Wonka, obviously, because it's a well-known character. You did the musical version at Tourcan.
We were the first regional production outside of the first equity production outside, I believe, of the Broadway and First National Tour.
Now, who is the character?
Well, Willy Wonka, of course. I mean, it's based on the character from the Roald Dahl novel, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. It's been made into, at this point, now at least three movie adaptations of Willy Wonka, the Gene Wilder version, the Johnny Depp version, and then now the recent Timothée Chalamet, which I have not seen. Well, for me, Willy Wonka, it really has to be, you have to look at the script and try to look at the story these people were trying to tell, as opposed to like, what is this version of Wonka and what are the necessary parts? So when I broke it down, there's not a lot of stage directions in the script for the Broadway version, the Mark Shaiman version that was just on Broadway with Christian Borle. And there's not a lot of stage direction. There's not a lot of stuff there telling you like how to deliver the lines. So for me, it was just me reading the script just over and over and over again, looking for the pattern. And it's just like, there's just like, there are these things like whenever a kid gets bumped off, spoiler alert, it's just like he always has a long monologue that's punctuated with, it'll be fine. And it's just figuring that that was a thing that every time it had to be a little bit different and it had to keep building every time. So in terms of technical aspects of the performance, I had to sort of dive in and get used to the language very, very quickly because I'd never played Wonka before. And then there was the idea of, well, everyone already has an idea of what this character is because it's such a well-known character. I mean, you have the version you think of when you read the book, which is very different from Gene Wilder. I mean, in the book, it says like he's a short man with a goatee, which is sort of what I look like. But no one thinks of Willy Wonka with a goatee, even though it is technically canon. I had to fight real hard to keep the goatee. I said, either I'm clean shaven or I have a goatee, but just don't make me shave it and then put facial hair on me because it is so hard to act with just a ton of things taped to your face. I hate it. I hate it so much. Well, so for me, like the more there comes a point where getting into a costume helps him with the character, but then like if it passes a certain point, it starts feeling restrictive physically. And then I feel that I have to now make choices based on the costume as opposed to what I think might be best for the character, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Now that's very much a what is the character? Who is the character?
He's a chocolatier. He's a dreamer. Well, at what I figured out is like he's an aging man who is starting to feel mortal for the very first time, which is something that, I mean, being a middle-aged man, you start figuring that stuff out in your 40s. It's like, ooh, I'm just going to ache a little bit every day because that's the way my body is going to be. And I think he's a man who doesn't know how to communicate very well, which is why he speaks in this very fast, weird, backwards talk. He hasn't talked to anyone except Oompa Loompas in years. So it's really a show about him coming back to terms with his own humanity. And my favorite part of it is that it's really a buddy comedy in which only one of the main characters knows it's a buddy comedy until the very end. So he's also he's a master planner, I guess, was my main thing about Wonka. Wonka plans. Because I was also in School of Rock as Dewey Finn. And actually, there's a lot of overlap between Wonka and Dewey, but the main difference is that Wonka is a much better planner. He's not coming up with everything off like the seat of his pants. He's like, this is planned for decades. And it's just unfolding that in a way that never comes across as threatening. And that you feel all the kids, because we did it with kids, not adults, that all the kids on stage are always safe. Like as an audience member, we never really feel like anything's going to happen to these kids. And a lot of that has to come with trust in your Wonka. And then you got to look back at everyone else who's ever played the role and figure out like, well, what works and what doesn't. I did not particularly enjoy the Tim Burton version with Johnny Depp. His Wonka didn't feel safe or accessible to me. And in the show, like I could never imagine Johnny Depp's Willy Wonka coming out and singing the Candyman. Like that would never happen with that character. Gene Wilder, what I love about his is that there's that sense of danger and just like behind the eyes glint that shows so well through camera work. But if you've never been to the Tuakon Amphitheater in Ivins, Utah, it is an over 2,000 seat amphitheater in the middle of it's outdoors in a canyon. So eye acting doesn't get you very far. So I had to figure out like mine had to be a lot about motioning and a lot about I have a cane and we're going to make grand sweeping gestures and try to just make the character come to life and tell the story as much as you can on such a giant canvas.
And you say that he only really talks to Oompa Loompas. So would you suggest that maybe there is that sense of loneliness inside him?
That's the thing. He was hurt. He was hurt when he was younger. He was a very generous man. This is the version we did at Tuaca. We added a little prologue at the beginning where we had like in Dumb Show in pantomime, we had like young Wonka come out and expel the spies from his factory and put a lock on the gate. So sort of telling everything to the audience that everything we say about Wonka is actually true. We can show it to you. And then when Charlie sings the song at the beginning about like the story of Wonka, that is actually how it happened. And Wonka was he doesn't trust anyone. But in that first scene with Charlie, Charlie gives him the idea for the golden tickets. And then I made it a subtextual choice that the director agreed with me on, that I then had to spend the rest of the first act trying to get him a ticket. And that does not appear in the script. But that was a choice I felt like we had to make, because if he gets the ticket and Wonka had nothing to do with it, then he's just lucky. And then there's no point to their relationship in the first act. But if they meet in the first scene and Wonka sees something in Charlie and is like, I don't care what happens, that kid gets a golden ticket because he deserves it. And then he goes through the rest of the first act because there's so many jokes about him trying to give the kid the candy bar. And he's like, I can't, I'm poor. I can't, I'm poor. And it happens so many times. It just comes across on the page that Wonka's just making fun of this kid for being poor. And I had to make a different choice. I'm like, I would hate myself if this were my Wonka. And I would hate Wonka if he was just making fun of this poor kid. So it ended up being the thing where it's like, no, I'm not. I want to give him the bar, but I can't because that's against the rules. He has to buy the bar. So there is a scene where I have him sweep up the shop and I give him a buck and it's a whole thing, but I had to make it part of the plan. And that unlocked the entire rest of the show for me.
You're making yourself very calculated and manipulative.
Yes. I mean, most people when I talked to him, Willy Wonka, they said he felt was almost like a devil figure. He's like, if you're naughty, Willy Wonka's going to kill you in his factory in a very ironic way.
Okay, so taking that sort of, I guess, shadiness, where do you start with inhabiting him and that first step in transferring the character off the page?
Well, they gave me the cane like day one.
Yeah.
Just like get used to the cane. And I love that cane. And as you know, in the Shaman version, in the first act, Wonka is not Wonka. He's incognito as the Candyman in the world of humans trying to find the kids. And he hangs out with Charlie a lot. But when he's Wonka, he has the cane and he has the hat and it's the whole thing. So for me, a lot of it happened in the rehearsal process, just working with the cane as an extension of myself. And also when I got the costume, that was a huge one. Because when I saw it, it says pink and gold. And it shone. When you hit the spotlight, I lit up like a disco ball. It was so cool. I called myself like the disco TARDIS when I went up in the great glass elevator.
I did ask you for that suit, didn't I?
Yeah, yeah. They did not let me keep the suit. We had so many versions of it too, because there were so many doublings we did. And then once I got that and I got the shoes, they had these dance sneakers that they ended up, they were these, no, dance loafers that they ended up just rubbering so that they would try to make it through an entire summer in the elements. It got real close at the end. I wore through those shoes real hard. But it sort of gave me my spine and it gave me what I needed to sort of begin moving around. And the other problem is, not necessarily a problem, but it's a feature of the Tuacon stage. It is the hugest stage I've ever worked on. And I can't think of one bigger other than maybe like the Muni in St. Louis. It's like, it's over a football field in length, American football. And it's, yeah, so it's just like, if you've got a big entrance to make, you got to enter like half a page before your line if you want to get center.
So I guess that would also change how you would normally play this character, say in the setting of a short film or a normal Broadway theater.
The size of the stage and the outdoor aspect of it makes it difficult in some ways because we started the show in twilight. So normally we can knock out all the lights and then focus everything on the one person who's doing anything. I had to walk out sort of into everyone's pre-show and be like, hey, everyone, let me sing a song. Usually it would get dark right around the end of Charlie's first song and then we could sort of roll in. It never got dark later than like the Augustus Gloop song, but it ended up being kind of hard to work around because you lose a little bit of the magic when you sort of appear in daylight.
Yeah.
And also it's just working outdoors means there's wind. And when there's too much wind, you can't fly the elevator. You have a whole song about the elevator.
And I saw the pictures and you were in midair. I didn't think of wind.
Yeah, we did about 5 or 6 shows with no elevator. And by the end of it, I just had to figure out like an improv speech that would not mention the elevator and just talk about something else being high up and then sing the song about being high up. But it was ridiculous because there were a couple shows where I just had to introduce an elevator that wasn't coming.
Yeah.
And then sing a song about the elevator that wasn't coming.
Oh, goodness me. Now, a friend of Bloop Network's, Diane Pilkington, just did Bedknobs and Broomsticks on tour. And it was Christmas Eve or Christmas night. And in one of the theaters, the magic wasn't working. The flying broom wasn't working. So because it was Christmas, the only reason she did this was because it was Christmas. She stood there and sort of jumped up on the spot and went, ooh, ooh, like that to act like she was flying. So you could have done that for your elevator.
No, we couldn't. Because there was no like the other thing with the stage that you can't really surprise anyone with any entrance because it takes you 10 seconds to get on. So unless there's a trap door, there's no surprise entrances. So it's just like, it was very obvious, like nothing's all right. And we're just going to move on with that. But we had so much stuff go wrong at various points. Like it was a 5-month run.
Yeah.
Like a lot of stuff can go wrong in that show because there's just a lot of effects. And then I eventually just had to have like a bit ready in case anything did not work.
But did you have the unknown?
The what?
The unknown.
The unknown. What is that? Oh, no, we did not.
That's what he said. What is this? It's the unknown.
Well, to be fair, like the idea of like a terrifying villain that's a mirror called the unknown is a pretty baller concept. It was the execution I have a problem.
Oh, no, the execution was wonderful.
But our Wonka looked so much better than that Wonka. Like, and unlike the Broadway version, we actually had a physical chocolate factory you could walk into and different rooms that had different sets. It was interesting. It was that crew worked their butts off so hard. Like the crew at Tuacon Amphitheater, they were just stunningly good. And I loved everyone I worked with.
Yeah. Oh, goodness me. Now, the way you described it as the friendship between Wonka and Charlie is a little bit Sling Blade. So what nuances or isms did you experiment with in the rehearsal process? And what did you have to cut out because of that amplified nature of performing in an amphitheater?
Well, I got really, really lucky with the Charlie I got. It's a guy named Charlie Stover. He's going to be a star. He's in a film out right now called Riddle of Fire. And he is one of the stars of that. He's in the TV show Yellowstone. Like, this kid is a pro. And I'd worked with him on School of Rock before, actually. So it's just like, oh my goodness, hey Chuck, what's up? And we got to have sort of reunion, and we already had a bit of a rapport, and I already knew what he could do. And so it was just so much of it was just being able to like kind of go to work with my buddy. It was just like, hey Chuck, what are we doing today? And then we could sort of try stuff out. And I remember like I sat him down. I'm like, hey, like this is not School of Rock where it's like Dewey and a bunch of kids. It's like, if you have ideas, if you have stuff that you want me to try that makes like that helps your stuff, tell me. tell the director, like, I want to work with, like, we're equals in this, buddy. And yeah, just being able to work through some stuff. I don't think we actually had to throw a lot of stuff away, because the way Michael Heitzman, the director, who's a wonderful human being and just a stunning visionary director, he sees things and makes them happen on stage in a way that mystifies me. But like he was very good about sort of just letting us develop it. And he was very good about me saying, like, I can't be too mean at any certain point, because there's that, of course, the villain turn at the end where he yells at Charlie because he broke the rules. And that has to be believable, but it's only believable if you build a relationship there. But fortunately, I already had a bit of a relationship there. And then the understudy for Charlie had to go on a few times, Mac, and he was great. He played Mike TV. So it was like watching him make the turn from Mike TV to Charlie Bucket was so awesome, watching this young actor just like do a complete 180. And actually, the very first time he went on was mid-show, because Charlie went out and did the very first number and his voice was gone, and we had to pull him out. And it was the first time that ever happened to him. It's a lesson we all got to learn. Sometimes we just don't have it on that day. And the understudy went on, Mac. He went on, bam, mid-show, nailed it. It was so cool to see.
What nuances did you bring to it that you kept?
I don't think there were a heck of a lot of nuances that I was bringing. Like, I think my Wonka that makes it different than other Wonka. But first of all, I don't look like a Wonka. Most Wonkas, especially, are of the Timothy Chalamet shape, where these like long, skinny, thin white gentlemen. I'm like, this guy's retiring and he works at a chocolate factory. Hashtag thick Wonka should be a thing. Like,
yes.
I look like a guy who's lived in a chocolate factory for the past 30 years. So it was interesting being able to just go out there and sort of like do my own thing with it and not have to be locked into any of the like the Johnny Depp or the Gene Wilder cadences, just because, or even Christian Borle cadences, because like I'm so not those guys. Yeah. No one looks at me and is like, be this other thing. They're like, oh, well, Jack Black is playing Wonka. Let's see what that happens here.
Everyone was thinking it.
Well, one of the reviews specifically mentioned it and mentioned like such a bold choice to make a Jack Blackish Wonka. I'm like, that's my face.
I saw that.
Like, that's not a choice. It's literally just my face.
But it's just a vibe. That's all it is. It's just a vibe.
I could have the same vibe, but if I looked like Timothy Chalamet, no one would call me Jack Black.
Okay. Did you base your portrayal or anything on anyone or anything?
I think the one thing I wanted to take from Gene Wilder was the idea that anything could happen at any time. And again, it's harder to do that on stage. And it's harder to do that when you don't have the benefit of like a close up and you're just dealing with like just a large empty thing. Michael Heitzman, the director, and Robbie Roby, the choreographer, they did a really good job of just being able to like sort of grab the audience in various different ways. But yeah, I really just drew most of my performance from just reading the script and just figuring out where my instincts were coming from there. And then Michael, of course, would sort of like push me into slightly different ways. But he, I mean, for the most part, let me create the sort of on my own. And like very few times he'd be like, that's a bit much. Or it's like, that's feeling a little mean right now. And he just sort of guide me a little bit. But I think it was just like we met up at the callback and we both had sort of the same idea of where we wanted to go with it. And we didn't want any cruelty out of Willie. And I think that that's a danger you can run into. It's like everyone has to feel safe. Everyone has to feel a sense of wonder, but everyone has to know that at the end, these kids are going home and they're fine. One of the few artistic battles I did lose was they made me have a wig, which I normally don't like, especially in 100-degree heat.
What was that, a wig?
Yeah. No. And like I have a full head of hair, but they made me wig because, and they finally explained it to me. They said, we don't want Willy Wonka to be completely sweat through by the end of the show. He still has to look fresh and magical. I'm like, oh, that makes a lot of sense. Dewey Finn can be a drowned rat out there by the end of the show, yeah. Which I was. Wonka has to be magical from beginning to end, even in an outfit where only your face and hands are exposed if you have to sweat to cool your body.
And that suit looked like it would have been quite warm too. It didn't look like it was light.
It was actually very breathable.
Oh, was it?
The problem is at the beginning for Candyman, where I had to wear the Candyman outfit and then overdress a second Wonka suit that tore away. So before the show, I start in the trap door. So before the show, at places, I had to walk down, get into the Wonka suit, wait for the pre-show announcement, wait for the prologue where Wonka shows up and like kicks everyone out. And then as Candyman vamp starts, I shoot up through the link and I turn around and I start singing Candyman. So like 5 to 10 minutes before the show, I'm still downstage just sort of hanging out in this outfit. But fortunately, it was below the stage. It wasn't that. We only had one show that last summer. I was like, oh, this is really, really uncomfortable.
Yeah, so you can imagine out in the bloody desert.
Well, but the shows start late because the sun goes down so late. So the show started like 8:45 at night. So it's cooled a bit.
Okay, now I've asked that. Now, what pieces of yourself did you inject into the character? I probably could have worded that differently.
What did I inject? Well, I think on every level, as an actor, it's just that there is no actor who can do everything. Just because you are gifted with the body you give and the person that you are, it's like I know some incredibly and I've watched incredibly versatile actors, but I've noticed that Meryl Streep is brilliant, but I've only seen her play dumb in one movie, and I hated that movie. She Devil. It's just like every other movie I've seen her do, she's smart.
Oh, and Wonka connection. Chris Catelli, who choreographed Wonka, is now choreographing and I think directing She-Devil, isn't it? No, Death Becomes Her. Sorry, scrap that.
She-Devil's the one with Roseanne Barr.
Yeah. It was that same high concept, Witches of Eastwick, powerful women. Yeah, it's that. There was a lot of them. They were great.
She's vapid and horrible, but she's not stupid in that movie.
No.
And it's one of those things where it's like, yeah, Jack Black is sort of limited by his body to the types of role. He's always going to be Jack Black. In the same way, Idris Elba is always going to walk into a room looking like Idris Elba. So he's going to obviously play roles that probably should look like Idris Elba.
Dreamy.
Dreamy, yeah. Dashing, yeah. Like suave, and with a little bit of danger. That's his thing. I think one of my things is that people don't look at me, at least on stage, and it's like, oh, that guy's dangerous, which is weird because like I'm like a hairy fat guy. So like there are ways to costume me where I do not look very appealing. But the thing I always try to bring, especially when I am working with kids, is just the idea to the audience is like everything is under control and I know exactly what is going to happen next. And if anything does happen, I got it. And I think that's where my improv background really has saved me in my career. It has saved me so on so many occasions because all improv is just acknowledging the truth in front of you and reacting like a human. And it's a harder thing to do than you think of when you're sick, because it's like you're always trained. It's like, oh, the show must go on. Stay in character. And sometimes it's just like, well, that was a thing that happened. And now we got it back. And just get everyone back.
Yes, I know it's like a host, Thresh and Treasure. We can go way off track and I need to pull it back in. Yes.
In a way, it is sort of like hosting when you're that sort of character, like a Dewey Finn or a Wonka or a Soodless, which is a role I've also played and had a great time doing. If you're going to break that fourth wall, you have to be able to be familiar with the audience and have them get on your side. And I think I've been able to do that largely in my career. I think I've only played like one or two like villains who weren't supposed to be at least fun villains. I played one just straight up hardcore villain in a play about Bosnia. And I think that was the only play I told my mom not to come see me in.
Oh, really?
I played a real bad guy. I had to do several things that are felonies on stage. And wasn't necessarily a thing I wanted my mom to see.
Anyways, okay. In what ways do you and don't you relate to Wonka?
It was a bit of a weird thing because I have had a connection to Wonka since I can remember. So it was just, I've always wanted to take a crack at it because I think that I am very mischievous. I am very quick of mind. And even though I'm not much of a dancer, I'm fairly light on my feet for my size. So it's just physically like it was a thing I thought I would be good at. And I think that going into the process of a longish run, I mean, it wasn't an open run, but like a 7-month contract is a very long contract for non-touring theater. It got to grow a little bit just by letting me settle into it a little bit, because the with a show with that much tech, it's just like you have to realize that I realized like I was the director trusted me enough where like we weren't doing a lot of straight runs of the show and we weren't doing a lot of that. So the first few runs of the show were just me making sure I had the show and I could be that person who could steer the ship. And if I wasn't, fake it till you make it. But by the end of the run, I was really having a lot of fun. And this act two, Wonka barely leaves stage. And then it's a marathon, but I managed to break it down in every single scene. There were at least two or three moments that I loved. Like they're just sort of like singing Pure Imagination and just having the fireworks go off over the canyon. Like that was, and then yeah, Pure Imagination was just, it was beautiful. Like they wheeled on this candy and we had living trees and like the elevator when it worked was so cool. But I also got to figure out that like Mrs. TV and me, we were the besties of friends. The woman who played Mrs. TV, Erin Studdard, she is a Broadway legend in her own right. She was Peggy Sawyer, 42nd Street on Broadway, and Babette, the Feather Duster in Beauty and the Beast. She's amazing. And so like, and she was the last parent, but her kid was the last one to really get killed. So like the whole scene, the whole act, we're just having so much fun playing off each other. And we had this thing where in the script, it's like, he's always making fun of her for the way she dresses and always making fun of her for like her makeup and stuff. And I decided, well, what if I decide that like, hey, Wonka's like, he hasn't been around for a bit. So he's like, what's up? And he's like, was really, really into everything Mrs. TV. And so we had this like burgeoning weird romance throughout the entire second act. And that was a thing I got to add purely because Erin Studdard is one of the funniest people I've ever worked with. And also we were in Tarzan running in rep and we were Tarzan parents at the beginning of Tarzan, we were paired up too. So it was just kind of hilarious that I got to be on a boat with her in both of those shows.
Now, I think Tarzan parents is also Elsa and Anna's parents, aren't they?
Is that part of the Disneyverse? I hadn't checked.
If you look at the pictures of the ship on both of them, I'm pretty certain it's the same ship. Yeah? And that the intention was that those people were their parents. I think that's what the intention. I might just be.
Khan's doing Frozen this year. I'm sure they've looked it up. Michael and Robbie, the same directing team that did Charlie.
Oh, wow. Okay, well, acting is reacting. So what balance, this last question that I've got, what balance is impulse versus that instinct when sort of things go wrong?
For Tuakon, you basically have to know the show so cold you can do it while having a conversation with someone else, because there is so much that can distract you in an outdoor theater where just, and it's just stuff you never would think of. It's just, I remember one night, it was like churro 2-for-1 night at like, and so everyone's bringing their churros down and like they're wrapped in these white pieces of paper. And then halfway through the show, a wind came up and it kicked all the churro like things into the air. So like, so just in the middle of the show, just a flurry of that, like one night, the fog machine in School of Rock went off in the wrong act. Like we were in a classroom and all the fog machines went. So like in that case, it's like I just kept trying to do the scene, but it was very obvious we had to acknowledge this. So I think what I said was just like, is it normally this foggy in the classroom? Probably not. And every time I told the kids to do something, I'm like, I added the words "in the fog," like, go kids, have fun, play in the fog. And I think they realized that was improv. And in Charlie, it's just like I said, like there's just so many moving parts and things deteriorate so fast in the Utah heat. And it's just certain things where it's just like, if there is a safety issue, we just don't do it. And so for me, I was always just trying to stay one ahead of everything. Cause like, first of all, is everyone on stage safe? Great. Is everyone in the audience still enjoying the show? Great. There are a bunch of kids and we are in Utah, the most conservative state in the American Union. So I have to be careful that what I improvise has to be very filtered and okay for a general audience. When I would jump in with stuff, it was usually stuff that I had an idea. If this goes wrong, I'll say something like this, or yeah. It's like depending on what goes wrong, like, oh, if this doesn't work, so there were a few moments of pre-plan, but in general you just have to just be ready.
What about bugs and birds and snakes and scorpions?
Bugs were not as much of a problem for me. Apparently the big one was Beauty and the Beast the year before. Lumiere actually had flames coming out of his hands, and so like the bugs would circle around the flames, and then the bats would try to eat. So Lumiere kept getting dive bombed by bats.
Oh my God. That, okay, I get dive bombed by bats in Australia all the time, but they are this big. Like they are huge, like massive, meter long. Yeah. Like when their wings are out.
These ones are little guys. These ones are only about 5-6 centimeters, but like they're little like mouse bats. And so like the regular Lumiere, he got used to it. So he just figured out how to like turn them on and off real quick.
Yeah.
But the understudy who went on, he was not, no one had told him.
Oh, wow. Oh my God. That's funny.
And the bats kept coming for him.
That is brilliant. Cause I at first I pictured massive bats and I'm like, no, it's America. So yeah, tiny ones, little tiny ones. But like here you go for a walk at night time, literally like this massive big, it's like Batman suddenly swooping out of the bushes at you right in front of you. You feel the wind on your face, you feel the bacteria hit you in the mouth, and you're like, I'm gonna die after this. But yeah. And I can imagine having a bird fly into someone's face or something, like Fabio on the coaster.
We had tarantulas, a lot of tarantulas. We had a couple snakes.
No.
Some small scorpions, but they weren't generally a problem. The big one was later in the season as the weather started getting cooler, raccoons. We actually like had to have a guy behind the stage with a flashlight, just making sure the raccoons weren't coming. And one night we had a raccoon make an entrance.
What about coyotes?
Actually, the coyotes we didn't have to worry about as much because there's enough light and there's enough things they didn't like it that as much. They said, if you ever do see a coyote, it's probably rabid. But in the 2 years I spent there, we only had one coyote warning at all.
Oh, wow.
Good. But yeah, Tuakon, it's so far away from everything. Like there's a town, Ivins, but it's not near Tuakon. Like you have to drive a mile and a half down a road and there is nothing else on this road. It ends at Tuakon and then it ends a mile and a half later at a gas station.
And it's so fascinating that people will drive all the way out there to see a musical.
Hundreds of thousands of people every year see these shows.
And look at what fails. Look at what fails because people don't go see it. And yet people will go out of their way to see theater.
Well, I mean, if you've never been, and this is just for anyone who's listening who's never been to the American Southwest, it is gorgeous down there. And if you want to visit any of the national parks down there, like Zion or Grand Canyon or Bryce Canyon, or go to Vegas, and you're wondering, hey, what else is there to do down here? Guess what? There's a show in Utah, 45 minutes from Vegas, and they are doing family-friendly entertainment 6 nights a week, a different show every single night. So it says if you come in for 3 nights to see the parks, you can see 3 different shows.
Yeah.
And they're always family friendly. And so I do understand why if people like every year, they're like, oh, yeah, we're going to do a national park. And then that then we're going to go see the Tuacon show that year. It becomes people come back year after year. And yeah, it's like, and I've only been there 2 out of the past 3 years. And it's just noticing the history of the place and the people who keep coming back. It's just it's nice to be a part of a community in that way.
And you say Utah is the most conservative state. I noticed Pioneer Theater Company in Utah did Rocky Horror recently.
I mean, there are cities and there is a gay community. We had Pride down in Southwest Utah without any event, there was no problems. Well, they're doing what they can out here. And they're also, but there are some theaters out in Utah that are doing stunning work. Like there's a lot of cool stuff in, like there are theaters in every state that like deserve an audience. But Tuacon seems to have really, really found their niche. Like we're doing family friendly, large scale musicals that fit in a canyon.
Yeah, and involve a big flood of water. And that's the other thing you have to worry about is sharks.
Well, yes, we did flood the stage for Tarzan. But unfortunately, the flooding of the stage means that if you do a tap show, you have to build a floor on top of it because the floor is rubber. So you can't tap on it. And you can have no automation. So every piece of scenery is moved by a human, usually groups of humans. But yeah, so yeah. Every time you see something coming out, that's not a track. That's something on wheels. And when the wind comes up, you better believe we got to weight those sets down because yeah. They are not knifed into the stage.
Goodness gracious me. Anyways, I can edit that. That'll be good. Hopefully that was all right for you.
Yeah. Or like, let me know if you listen back and you're like, hey, let's try it again. Like I got a better like concept. Or like, if you want to try it again, I'd be happy to do it again. Get your practice on.
Well, that's also the point of having a guinea pig is to test things out and see how do we grow an ear on your back.
Yes, but if you ever wanted to do this for real and put it into the world, we could do another one.
Oh, look, I think that one's fine. Is there anything that you wanted to talk about in terms of taking on the character?
I just say like in terms of anyone who's going out for any part that's been like that has an iconic performance in the role is like, don't be afraid to be yourself. Which is weird coming from a guy who was constantly told he looks like someone else, but don't be afraid to be yourself because those are the things that don't be a crappy version of someone else. Be the best you can be. And that is the only thing you can really bring to it. And so it's almost like, I don't think I could have done Wonka another way and done it honestly. I think that this is the version of Wonka I was supposed to do. And if I ever get to do it again, I hope I do, because I'd really love to tackle that again. But like, I feel very good about the work I did. And yeah, I guess that's really all you can ask for, is that like, I went out there, I made a bunch of people happy, and I was proud of the show.
Yeah. I'm saying this because you're my friend. You know, I will criticize till the cows come home. You don't look like Jack Black. Jack Black looks like you.
Bam. Thank you.
I don't know Jack Black. I don't talk to Jack Black, so
I met him once and he was nice.
Yeah. Oh, awesome. Alrighty, so we're gonna listen back over that and see how the format works and tweak a few things and add a few things, and then I'm gonna record with another person coming up soon, which will possibly be the proper pilot episode for this new show, Caught in the Act. So if you have anything you'd like to add or any advice or anything you think was missing, please let me know at Thresh and Treasure on Twitter or at Thresh and Treasure Podcast on Instagram. And you can find Jonathan Wagner at Mr. JWags on all the socials and also on YouTube at Mr. JWags channel, where you can hear him talk about all things sumo. So a huge thank you again to Jonathan for joining me, and a thank you for listening, and I hope it all works, and we might see you next time. Uru.